Mr. Churchill said if Ike commanded the land armies, Britain was entitled to the top admiral. Mr. Churchill's son, Randolph, argued the issue with the member from Alden, Tom Dryburgh, who defended the Labour government position in allowing an American admiral. First, Mr. Churchill.
I am opposed to an American being given this job on the principal grounds that the communications of the Atlantic are vital to Britain's survival. They are a matter of life and death to us. They are not vital or a matter of life and death to the Americans.
A British admiral will certainly be in control of our own fleets around our own shores, and I presume, in fact, I'm quite sure, that it was only because of the vital necessity of defending our shores that this appointment was ever agreed to.
The point I was trying to deal with was the question of the strengths of the two fleets. I fully admit that the American fleet is much larger, and it's very sad that our fleet is so small. I'm certainly not getting hot around the collar on the principle of rule Britannia, because after 6 years of socialism, Mother Hubbard has replaced Britannia as the symbol of British sea power.
I want first to deal with one or two of the other points that Randolph Churchill has just made. I'm very sorry that he sees fit to sneer at the Royal Navy as it is.
How have I sneered at it?
He and I, you said you didn't think much of it and so on.
I said I didn't think it was large enough.
He and
I never questioned its quality, but its quantity.
Don't interrupt.
I will interrupt if you make false accusations against me of sneering at an institution which I've been brought up to revere.
I know you were brought up to revere it.
I still do.
Quite rightly, and we all do. But honestly, you and I both saw something of the Royal Navy in the Far East.
The Americans want at this moment allies, not satellites. But it is the socialists who are turning us into satellites of the Americans by not standing up for our just and legitimate interests.
Well, I absolutely disagree.
But I want to get back to that.
You talk both at once. Nobody will hear you.
Any other week, this next news story would have made only the Yale Daily News. This week, it threatened to rekindle the War of 1812. The crack British rowing crew at Oxford University chose its coxswain and captain for 1951. He was George A. Carver, Jr., a graduate of Yale, now studying on a scholarship in England. That certain naval person and even Lord Nelson might never get over it. But the coxswain from New Haven took his new command in his stride.
It's all right now, but the first few days we were out, utter chaos resulted on a couple of occasions. They rather regard me as an odd specimen, but I regard them as interesting specimens too, so we sort of analyze each other and everybody is rather happy about the whole situation.
In Korea this week, there was general progress across the wide front. General Bradley had told the Senate that the United States had roughly a quarter of a million men in Korea. And yesterday, more than 160,000 UN troops were attacking. For the first time in the Korean War, MacArthur's command had numerical superiority over the enemy below the 38th parallel. A two-pronged attack was jabbing the enemy defenses south of Seoul. The South Korean Foreign Minister, Ben Lim, paid tribute to his nation's allies and his own people.
The determination of the Korean people has become stronger and more determined. This is one of the great characteristics of the Korean people. They are one of the most stubborn races in the world. That's why they call them the Irish of the Orient. They are stubborn.
But all the news from Korea was not the kind you shouted about. There were 1,500 casualties this week. The total now more than 50,000. 8,600 dead. And this week, one of those 8,600 started the long boat trip home. On Sunday, near Yeoju, on the banks of the Han River, with bared heads and muddy boots, they stood in the puddles of slush and listened to a GI choir sing a battlefront funeral service for Major General Bryant Moore of the U.S. 9th Corps, who died after his helicopter crashed on Saturday. A former commandant of West Point, combat veteran of Guadalcanal and the fight for Cologne, General Moore is the third U.S. general to die in Korea.
Here was a man to pit against the mountains and the sea. Here was a man who gave his life to the preservation and perpetuation of those priceless gifts of liberty, freedom, and justice. General Moore was a soldier. A soldier to match the Korean mountain. Its rivers in flood today. Its seas and its muddy rice paddies. General Moore, as him that may be said today, he has fought a good fight. He has finished his course. He has kept the faith. Amen.
Also dead in Korea was the hero of Sutton Ridge, Lieutenant Harry E. Sutton, whose platoon held a vital ridge at the Hungnam evacuation in December, and who got a bullet in his heart on February 3rd. He was a Negro. In Korea, the hint of spring brought only mud and all the weariness that mud always means to a soldier. Like the mud in the hills of Italy in World War II, it was bogging down our trucks and tanks. Here is correspondent John Jefferson, standing beside a bridge at the Han River.
I am at the Han River, just north of Hsungju. The heavy rains of yesterday that have made the roads of the front a mire of mud have washed out a series of bridges and bypasses. And L5 Liaison plane going over. The only way you can cross this river now to the front at Wanju is to go over in a plane.
For the rest of the world, the prospect of spring meant the usual many things to many men. And as the earth stirred, there was a traditional flirtation with the herbs of optimism and the searching of the heavens for the possible return of the doves of peace. Those who bothered to think remembered that for 2 years the predictors have told us to watch the spring of 1951, that the Soviets might move then, that this was Europe's flashpoint when the Cold War might grow hot. We're about to take you to several capitals of Europe for brief weather reports. Not the meteorologist kind of report, but on the climatic conditions for peace or war, which may determine whether we live or die. First, we take you to Paris and CBS correspondent David Schoenbrunn.
You know what I think is going to happen this spring, Ed? The French cabinet will fall, and a farmer in Ecuador will see a flaming, saucer-shaped object whizzing through the skies. Our wives will buy white satin hats for Easter, and we'll sit around grousing about the high cost of living, but there isn't going to be any war this spring. I think the worst we can expect is a continuation of the hit-and-run tactics with which the communists and Russians have been plaguing the world since 1945. Yet we have survived these hot and cold wars so far and have actually gotten stronger in the process. I've thought all along that we wouldn't be plunged into war, but until this week I felt almost naked and alone, way out on a limb with only my optimism to keep me warm. Now I find myself in some pretty fine company. That limb is getting crowded. Authoritative reports from Washington and Moscow now speak of a détente, an easing of international tensions. And that's particularly encouraging, for it's in those capitals that the issue of war or peace will be decided. Here in Paris, people are much more worried about inflation than war this spring. They're fairly sure that Russia won't risk a general war in the face of America's atomic superiority. And they're confident now that America won't chase the elusive rainbow of preventive war. So we're looking forward to a peaceful springtime in Paris, and who could ask for more?
From Paris to Richard Hottolet in Germany, where collision between East and West is always possible.
Here in Germany, Ed, we see no cause for either greater optimism or more pessimism than we've felt for the past 6 months. This spring promises to bring little more than continued deadlock with no important change in the balance of power. The most urgent question is still, what are the Russians going to do? And that question is now as far from being answered as it ever was. The Soviet army in eastern Germany is as strong as before, perhaps a little better trained and equipped. But for all one can see, it's just as capable of sitting still for another 5 years as it is of attacking within a week. The communist peace offensive is being whipped up to a new climax with appeals to German patriotism and the promise of unity. The four-power meeting lies just ahead. But you can't tell whether Moscow is now concentrating on political means or is just building up a huge peaceful alibi in preparation for war. For the rest, it's fairly easy to say what this spring holds in store. The West has lost momentum. The European defense program seems to have bogged down in conferences and indecision. There will be a revision of the German occupation statute any day now, but too little and too late to rouse enthusiasm. The bigger project of restoring German sovereignty will hardly begin in the next 3 months, and the problem of rearming Germany seems once again to have been put on ice. There is something new in the spring air, though. People have learned to live with the prospect of disaster. The future is as murky as ever, but slightly less disturbing.
One of the specters of spring is a possible attack on Yugoslavia by Russia or its satellites. Winston Burdett in Italy covers the Yugoslav beat as well. Here is Burdett's estimate of what spring will bring.
My own feeling is that Western Europe is going to get through the spring of 1951 without any major outbreak. In saying this, I know that I'm reflecting the mood and opinion of people here in the country where I live and work. There has been a change of mood over here, a change for the better. Various things that have happened in the past 2 months help account for it. For one thing, Europeans have now stopped just talking about their defense and have gotten down to actual work at it under the high command of General Eisenhower. Then, the fear that haunted Europe just a very short time ago, that the military potential of America might be swallowed up in a bottomless war with China, this fear has been dissipated. Finally, and most important, the United States has decided to remobilize her industrial and military strength. Russia can do nothing to stop this rearmament of the greatest industrial power on Earth. Indeed, a Russian preventive war launched this spring would only accelerate the process. So, if the Russians cannot stop the rearming of America and do not dare to challenge it, then they will have to come to terms with it sooner or later. For these reasons, European leaders today are breathing more easily, or I should say, more confidently. I know there's one danger that tends to spoil this generally optimistic picture, the danger of another so-called limited war waged by Russia's rearmed satellites against Yugoslavia. But presumably such a war could happen only if the Russians delude themselves into thinking that it could be finished quickly and that it could be kept limited. If this is so, then the best thing the West can do to keep the peace this spring in Europe is to destroy any illusions the Kremlin may have about another limited war with a firm and unequivocal warning.
Here is how the situation looks to correspondent Pepper Martin in Tokyo.
Spring in Asia has many faces. When the cherry blossoms bloom in Japan, two American National Guard divisions will arrive to give the conquered Japanese people a feeling of security. In Korea, the second thaw and the early spring rains will freshen the bleak countryside, but the mud will mire motorized United Nations divisions. Indochina's jungles will be ripped by the fierce monsoon rains, virtually ending all military activity. But the 100-mile-wide straits between Formosa and the China mainland will become calm, ideal for fishing or for invasion. Asia is torn apart by six wars, ranging in size from the massive police action in Korea to the sporadic Hot Dalahap ambushes in the Philippines. Despite this preoccupation with war, there is infinitely less fear now than 2 months ago that World War III will suddenly explode in Asia. Korea is a stalemate. The United Nations do not have the manpower to reconquer the country. They could not hold North Korea while Manchuria remains a privileged sanctuary. The Chinese probably could win only if they use massive air power against our ports and over the front. The Reds have been warned that if they intervene decisively by sea or by air, their bases in Manchuria and China will be bombed. Indochina is a stalemate. Chinese intervention could upset the balance, but after the Korea experience, it seems doubtful Peking is ready for another adventure. Formosa is a stalemate. Without Russian aid, the communists probably could not successfully assault the island. Without American logistical support, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek certainly could not invade the mainland. The three critical points in Asia are in uneasy balance. Neither the communist nor the non-communist world can reach a military decision in Korea, Indochina, or Formosa without risking World War III. and there is no evidence that Communist China plans any move that would precipitate a world conflict.